Hi, everyone, and welcome. We are really excited to be kicking off to the symposium part of John Cage Mycology Weekend. Can everyone hear me okay? So I'm just going to introduce myself first. My name is Leah Friedman, and I have pretty much no qualifications to be speaking in front of a crowd about mycology. I am just someone who loves mushrooms. And in other parts of my life, I've been working as an organic vegetable farmer, as an outdoor educator, and as an educator around whole sexuality, working with people from ages 8 through 22, even some people here at Bard College. And what do those things have to do with mycology? As we know, John Cage was a pretty incredible polymath, and part of what I've learned from being at the first annual John Cage Mycology Weekend is that rather than mycology and music being disparate interests, they're actually interests that deeply inform one another and mutually reinforce and support one another. And I'm coming to Mycology Weekend by being a little bit of a generalist polymath who finds that mycology informs and influences how I engage with those other parts of my life.
Yeah. Hi, I am Mary Greca. I also am unqualified. Which is, I think, kind of a special thing about mycology now, that there's lots of folks who are self-taught and just a general nerd about mycology and ecology. And through discovering mycology, I have learned so much about other systems, and that's really inspiring to me.
Yeah, so just before we go into our talk, I want to say a couple thank yous. And of course, there to Laura and Emmy from the John Cage Trust, and to our dear friend Seth.
Yeah, thank you.
And to Seth, who put together all of the audio and visual for this entire event, in addition to being one of the presenters. So like a huge thank you to him as well.
Also want to thank all of our teachers across the kingdoms, humans and otherwise, that we can learn a lot of lessons from them. And that's what we're here to share, what we've gleaned.
Yeah, so it's really a privilege to be here with the other folks who are presenting. And it's really humbling to be with people who know so much more about mycology than we do. And my hope is that over the course of our talk, we'll get questions and we'll get comments and filling in of information from all the incredibly passionate and knowledgeable people in the room. And some of the things that we'll ask of you, you don't need to know anything about mycology to help participate in that conversation.
Yeah, cool.
Well, I wanted to start with a quote from an author that I'm gonna reference several times through our talk. His name is Robin Wall Kimmerer. She is a professor of ethnobotany and bryology at SUNY Syracuse. She's also an enrolled member of the Potawatomi Nation, and she's written a really incredible book called Breeding Sweetgrass about the sort of melding together of traditional ecological knowledge with more academic systems of knowledge. And we're gonna be making some plugs for the books that have inspired us. So something that's really instructive for our talk is her quote saying, "In the native way of knowing, we say that humans have the least experience with how to live and thus the most to learn. We must look to our teachers among the other species for guidance." And some of you may know that fungi are some of the most ancient beings on the planet. And so in fact, they do have a lot more experience with how to live than we do. Not diving quite into mycology yet, but I'd like to read this poem to you. I've known for a long time. It's a poem by Sylvia Plath. And when some people teach it, they actually don't include the title, which is mushrooms, and like to ask the people that they're reading it with to guess what this poem is about. So you can kind of hold that as I read it to you. Overnight, very whitely, discreetly, very quietly, our toes, our noses, take hold on the loam, acquire the air. Nobody sees us, stops us, betrays us. The small grains make room. Soft fists insist on heaving the needles, the leafy bedding, even the paving. Our hammers, our rams, earless and eyeless, perfectly voiceless, wide in the crannies, shoulder through holes. We diet on water, on crumbs of shadow, bland-mannered, asking little or nothing. So many of us, so many of us. We are shelves, we are tables, we are meek, we are edible. Nudgers and shovers in spite of ourselves, our kind multiplies. We shall by morning inherit the earth, our foot's in the door.
Yeah, so I hear a lot of reaction to that, so I want to kind of open it up to those of you who are here. What does this poem bring up for you? What is this about? You're doing us a favor right now. We need you to succeed, so.
I mean, shall inherit the earth.
Yeah. It's like some modesty there, too. Right on water on columns.
Yeah. It occurs to me that fungi are greatly overlooked by all of us. And part of some of the, I see they're nodding their heads up there because they're just not understood or looked at by the average person at all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And yet they're so strong. They're moving through pavement.
Any other kind of identifications, like with things that are not mushrooms?
So,
yeah.
I mean, it speaks very much about how aggressive they are without making noise about their aggression.
Yeah.
That they proliferate, they move, they spread, they invade, but not in a negative manner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're really incredibly strong.
The proletariat.
Yeah, there's absolutely something about kind of like class struggle in this. Someone over here.
I was just going to say, Sylvia Plath was obsessed with death and dying too.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel a lot of, like, when we were reading it, I was feeling sort of my body being taken by the fungal world. and that kind of,
And fungi are sort of tenders to death.
Any other kind of comments?
I read something recently about the experience of change and how change, you know, you might think kind of happens suddenly, but it's actually this thing that is incremental and barely noticeable, and then all of a sudden it's there, and you're in this kind of new phase or whatever.
Two of the other things I just want to point our attention to before we move forward is I find this description of mushrooms to be incredibly feminized. Just that there's, I think, such a gender dynamic about, like, to me when I read this, I'm hearing about just sort of the domestic, like we are shelves, we are tables, we are meat, this idea of sort of people who have been relegated to a domestic sphere really rising up and breaking through, and I think that that's an incredible undertone of this poem. I also want to point us to the fact that the whole thing is written in the first person plural, that there's no I in this poem, it's always we, and the idea of sort of being a collective, of being of containing multitudes is very much inherent, I think, in how we are learning to see fungi and fungi's role within ecosystems. Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for adding to that. I already feel like I know more about it. So one of the first things that we're going to talk about is kind of what is modern mycology? We're sort of at a moment of a new movement in mycology, the sort of a burgeoning interest among really different types of people. And what's that about? What characterizes it, and what does it mean, sort of on a cultural level, not just a biological one? I'm just going to see some of the themes that come through the modern mycology movement are diversity, or connection, or mutuality, and reciprocity. Mary, do you want to say anything about it?
And something that strikes me about the modern mycology movement is that it's sort of like a grassroots movement, in that it's folks who don't have necessarily institutional learning who are contributing a lot to the collective knowledge, which is important in cultivation, but also in citizen science projects.
Yeah, I don't know if many of you have read, there have been these really interesting articles recently. Most recently, many of you probably read the article about how 30% of the birds in North America have disappeared without anyone noticing. Yeah, I'm seeing a lot of nodding here. And what that has to do with the relationship between institutional academic science and naturalists. You may have read another article recently about how our country is actually experiencing a dearth of naturalists. And there's been an interesting relationship between the academy and naturalists where sometimes those things have gone hand in hand, and sometimes I think some have turned up their noses at the other, but naturalists, people who go out and observe the natural world, are in fact crucial for science because they're able to sometimes see a bigger picture that folks who are focusing on increasingly specialized bodies of knowledge are not always able to engage with. And mycology, I think, is really at the frontier of a movement that has gained so much momentum and continues to really receive its data from people who are naturalists, who are amateurs, who engage in citizen science, whether it's tracking the naturalization of the golden oyster, as this incredible PhD student Andy Bruce is doing, or people who are engaging in the Mycoflora project that you're probably gonna hear more about from John. But just that people who are naturalists, who are amateurs in the true sense of the word, not the like Paul Stamets sense of the word, people who just love it, they're outdoors, are building this from the ground up. And that's actually incredibly valuable as we're seeing things like species loss, that, that people who are just out there in the woods paying attention have a really valuable voice and place to play, as do scientists and academics, that those things have to go hand in hand. So I'm thinking a little bit of asking this question, what characterizing modern mycology is, not just what is it as a movement, what are its principles, but like what does mycology mean to us? How does it resonate throughout our lives? Because this is a movement that retains an interest in taxonomy, in cultivation, in the biological application of mushrooms, just like I think sort of more traditional mycology does, but it's also really interested in how mycelial networks and connections can inform more equitable social, cultural, and political structures. And so on those ends, I want us to look at the aims of some different mycological associations, just to sort of see what are these organizations stating as their purpose? What are they interested in doing in the world? So, this is an image from an event that a lot of us here in the room attended, the New Moon Mycology Summit in the Adirondacks, and here's some political art for your viewing pleasure. For folks who are listening on the radio, it is an image of a hand-painted poster with the words Myceliate the State on it, and mycelium growing out of the letters. So I'm going to point us to the mission statements of the New York Mycological Society and then also the North American Mycological Association, both groups that are incredibly active, inspiring, and wonderful. I'm going to read those statements. So the New York Mycological Society's mission. NYMS is a nonprofit organization of members who share an interest in mycology, the study of mushrooms and fungi, as well as mycophagy, the eating of mushrooms. The present NYMS was reincarnated some 50 years ago by the composer John Cage and a small group of other mushrooms and lovers. So we see the primary. I've been reading John Cage's letters to Bruce Cunningham, so I think that's inspired. So you can see kind of the primary interest there is interest in mycology and in mycophagy. And NYMS, as we know, some people here, has been the primary group that has inspired them and brought them into communities. These are great goals. NAMA's mission. NAMA is committed and dedicated to the promotion of scientific and educational activities related to fungi. NAMA supports the protection of natural areas and their biological integrity. NAMA advocates the sustainable use of mushrooms as a resource and endorses the responsible mushroom collecting that does not harm fungi or their habitats. So again, these are great and important goals, and these groups do incredible work in the world. And I want to now point us to some groups that have sprung out of the radical mycology movement and just look at the specific language that they're using to describe their mission and their work in the world. So this is the mission statement of the Mycelial Network, which is sort of the organizing group behind radical mycology movement. So, members of the Mycelial Network support their local communities by increasing access to mycological information for people of all backgrounds through the open dissemination of relevant information and our materials. All organizations and members of the Mycelial Network provide this information in a manner that is egalitarian, all-inclusive, and does not discriminate on the basis of age, gender, ethnicity, religion, mental health status, race, culture, sexual orientation, general appearance, income level, living situation, or experience in social or mycological work. We can pause there for a second. Just sort of, what is the aim of this group? What does it mean for this to be in the mission statement? And I'm going to read, I'm sorry folks on the radio, but I'm not going to read every single one of these, but I want to, it's up there for folks to read, but I want to really focus on one of the points of the primary goals, which is, there's a lot about, again, you did the biological application of fungi, but to discourage the exploitation of fungi, fungal remediation, and bioremediation by government and corporate interests. And then after that, to honor the wisdom offered by our ancestors and descendants, human, fungal, and otherwise. I'm curious to hear what folks think about this. Something that came up for me and for Mary as we were sitting and talking about this is that even the folks who've been sort of heralded in a lot of mycological movements as sort of the messengers of the mushrooms do things like patent fungal technology and make it so that other folks are not able to use that technology.
Like ecomative?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of examples of folks who are interested in mycology taking what they've learned from the fungi and patenting it and making it so that technology is something that they are able to reap profits on rather than something that's shared. And so groups like this, I think, recognize that so-called green capitalism is still capitalism, and radical mycology as a movement is opposed to capitalism. So it's not about selling green solutions, it's about promoting structural change. And so I'm gonna have us look at the Mycelium Underground, which is another organizing network. It's a group of people who created the New Moon Mycology Summit, which is also in its second year. So the Mycelium Underground, organizers devoted to bringing people together for the love of learning and embracing the world of fungi and all which fungi intertwine. The Mycelium Underground hears the call for more information in different avenues to create community within the world of mycology and social justice. The Mycelium Underground aims to bridge the gaps that are often forgotten within science and education. So again, what are we seeing with these groups that's kind of radically different from what previous mycological groups have stated as their aims? Yeah.
Science for the people.
Yeah, thank you. That's a really great way to put it. Anyone else?
Also, it's a come into a period of time in the last, I don't know, 10 or 15 years of actual interdependence of disciplines to look at topics. So that you wouldn't want to look at history of people without looking at their botany and all parts of the way they live, not just, let's say, the king or the government's structure or something. So it's like we're in a good period of time for us to understand more things, because a lot of people have realized that narrow isn't always better.
Yeah, thank you. It's really well put. That, right, there's no such thing as studying fungi without recognizing the incredible diversity of people who fungi can bring together, and that any study is impoverished if all voices and people are not at the table. So we're going to start moving into the next part of our talk, which is going to be about some of the lessons that we can learn from fungal ecology, and you're going to hear some incredible information about fungal ecology from Mary. But I'm really glad that you brought up what you did just about the interrelatedness of subjects, because I think one of the major lessons that we learn from fungi, as in any study of ecology, is just that everything is related. This is a picture that I took at Alana of Bear's Head Tooth. Herculeum fungus is 2 years in a row. And just every time I go visit this old friend, I'm just sort of struck by, there's no way for me to learn about Herculeum without learning about pileated woodpeckers who made the holes that the fruit body's coming out of, without learning, well, not this particular tree, but usually when I'm learning about bear's head tooth, I'm also learning about beech trees, because that's where I typically find them. and learning about colonies of ants that those pileated woodpeckers are looking for. So it's a really important lesson for me always that there's no such thing as just studying mushrooms. It's studying the entire system.
Right, so there are a few different primary ways that fungi relate to other organisms. First is saprophytes, or the decomposers, and then mycorrhizal fungi, which are mutualistic symbionts with plants. They can't exist without a plant as a host. Then there's parasitic fungi, which are sometimes pathogenic. They rely on other living organisms as a food source and sometimes for shelter. Then we have endophytic fungi, which live inside other organisms, endo meaning inside. They're often neutral or beneficial to their hosts, but have the potential to become pathogenic. And then lichen are a community of organisms, including at least one algae and two fungi. And fungi are similar to eusocial organisms in that they are community-minded. They exhibit distributed intelligence across individuals in a group to form a collective intelligence, essentially a communal body. So they can be seen as simple and discrete as an organism, but they're powerful working in tandem as a complete group. It's also worth noting that fungi are not always discrete in their roles and can switch between them. Like, the more I researched, the more it became sometimes blurry who was who. All right, so first let's talk about the saprophytic fungi. These are fungi that we're probably pretty familiar with already as commonly consumed and cultivated species like shiitakes, oysters, button mushrooms, maitake. And then if we look closer at our foods, they are also in beer, bread, tempeh. They're part of a lot of what we consume. So all fungi are heterotrophic, meaning they do not produce their own food. They cannot convert carbons into sugars for energy. So one thing that makes fungi unique is that they digest outside of their body. They excrete enzymes into their environment, which break down food sources before they're absorbed. These enzymes are responsible for decomposition, without which our forests would be massive piles of dead trees. Fungi are responsible for almost 90% of decomposition on Earth. So that's pretty powerful. Saprobes are essential to returning valuable nutrients like carbon, nitrogen, phosphorus, sulfur, and water back into systems through decomposition of organic and inorganic materials, whether it be wood, food, pollen, or the remains of other organisms. They complete the arc with bacteria between death and life by sublimating and recycling waste. As tenders of death, it is interesting that the highest rates of decomposition happen in the winter under snowpack. So much activity happening in a season associated also with death. Saprobes are chemical masters. They unlock unavailable nutrients and make them soluble for other organisms. Through extracellular enzymatic digestion, fungi have the special ability to break down complex molecules into simpler ones. This includes lignanocellulose, which is a complex polymer that makes certain plants woody, and complex hydrocarbons like petroleum products. It also includes solubilizing nitrogen into forms readily absorbed by plants and degrading rock into minerals and metal ions. Woodrat fungi are the only organisms equipped to process lignin, the compound in lignanocellulose that is resistant to decay. Different types to varying degrees. White rot excel at this task, while brown rot specializes in degrading cellulose. And soft rot, which is in damp soil conditions, can degrade both. Those a bit slower at nibbling away at the niggling. After brown rot digests most of the cellulose from wood, what's mostly left is the lignin. This material, which looks cubical or stringy, has a spongy texture allowing it to hold water and nutrients and give shelter to tiny creatures. Since most terrestrial carbon is tied up in lignin and cellulose, woodwright fungi are crucial to carbon cycles and the creation of soil humus. A byproduct of this recomposition is a softening up of wood for other creatures to create shelters. It's also fun to note that bioluminescent fungi are white rock fungi. And these heavy hitters in natural environments may play a role in cleaning up contamination. Fungi can uptake heavy metals and begin to degrade plastics. Fungi are keystone organisms. Saprobes are some of the first organisms to inhabit disturbed environments, especially burn sites, creating in combination with lichen, simple soils, and transporting water to barren or rocky sites, making way for bacteria to grow. In this context, we may think of them as guiding succession and as pioneers. Some insects have co-evolved with fungi and farm them for food, including some ants, termites, ambrosia beetles, and wasps. In the case of the Atta ant, an obligate symbiont, so that means they have to have a partnership. Atta ants collect leaf cuttings that they bring back to their colony to feed the Leucoagaricus fungi growing within. So there's like the mound that the ants have made and burrow into, and there's literally a fungal mass at the heart of it. In exchange, the fungi develops a hyphal mass, which becomes a food source for larvae of the ant. The ants regulate the airflow and humidity for the fungus through opening and closing air passages within the colony. And they also produce antibiotics, which help to prevent contamination of the fungi by other pathogens. And moving beyond terrestrial ecosystems, the spores of the fungi interact with condensation in the air, becoming the nuclei for raindrops. With such heavy spore loads, this could mean that fungi play a part in cloud and rain formation. Yeah, that's a lot.
So part of just our project and what we're thinking about is, like, as we learn these things, like, yes, there are facts to learn, but what lessons do they have for our systems? And I don't want to, we're not treading on what's already really incredible information about sort of biological applications and biomimicry having to do with bioremediation, sort of using mushroom mycelium to clean up toxic environments, essentially, is a fairly simplified way of putting it, or about training them to digest petroleum products, which is something people do. That's incredible. Those are biological applications of the role that fungi play in an ecosystem. But when we think about emulating mushrooms, about having our own systems resemble these incredible systems, what are the questions that come up? What does it mean to look more closely at our own waste streams, to reconceptualize waste products as something that can be reincorporated, as something that can be digested, things that can be usable? Did you want to say something? Oh yeah.
In thinking about waste streams, there's a woman that I met recently, Nance Glenn, who works a lot with waste and with soil, and she has said, our environment is shaped by what we choose to observe, but while our most abundant products are waste, these byproducts of our activities are so plentiful and often so strangely formed, it is either difficult or impossible to contemplate them, let alone safely hold or fold them into a substrate that is able or willing to digest them. Working with waste challenges cultural taboos as well as presenting an environmental risk, but sane, low-tech systems for processing waste also present a real solution to reconnecting our bodies to the earth. All we have to do is first pull out the thorn of ingrained prejudice.
Yeah. So, as we kind of ask that question of sort of what does it mean to really reconsider our waste streams, something that I got to thinking about, and I'll be curious to hear what you think, is sort of mycophobia and how that's held in a lot of cultures. So the fear of mushrooms, the fear of touching mushrooms, eating mushrooms, all those things. I work with kids outdoors a lot, and one of my favorite things to do is to look at mushrooms with them. And for every kid who's like, ooh, a mushroom, there's always a kid who goes, oh, I don't like mushrooms, they're gross, they're slimy. And I think there is a lot of culturally held fear around mushrooms. And one of the questions that I've been asking as we've been talking about this talk is not just the fear of poisoning, but what does cultural mycophobia have to do with the fact that mushrooms deal with two of the most pervasive taboos in the entire world, which are dead bodies and human waste. Mushrooms are the things that engage with them and repurpose them.
And thrive there.
And thrive, right? Mushrooms have no fear of dead bodies or of human waste. And to what extent could mycophobia around the world have to do with the taboos around death and around waste and the fear that our cultures have around them, as we know?
Yes.
My impression as a veterinarian is that most people's fear of mushrooms has to do with the trainee's children, mm-hmm. and I was also a nature counselor, and it's really very rigid whether or not their parents said, don't ever touch a mushroom because they're poisonous, and maybe indeed domestic mushrooms in their normal food. But I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of the person who wrote Foraging Without Fear, mm-hmm. his first edition, was, yes. Eat nothing with guilt. And I really think if everyone just knew that, you can touch a mushroom and eat nothing with guilt. So I know it's not true, but that's at least a place to start. So if I have clients who have small children and dogs and mushrooms growing in their yard, they're clearing everything out. Right, because they're so afraid of mushroom poisoning, which certainly can happen. I've seen dogs with mushroom poisoning.
Sure.
But I don't think the fear is about death or associations with waste this literally ignorance about the risk of poisoning, which isn't zero.
Mushroom poisoning.
But I really think it's as simple as that. And
sure.
It's a different way of people thinking about them. Just don't eat them.
Yes, and
yes,
there's a lot of really interesting research recently done by people who are cultural historians and mycologists about how there are mycophilic and mycophobic cultures throughout the world, and not every culture has the same amount of knowledge or fear regarding mushrooms, and where does that come from? And I'm not an expert on that, so I can't speak fully to that.
When you talk to your kids who are afraid of mushrooms, have you ever just asked what their family or parental experience is? Why do they hate them? I mean, is it really visceral? They think they're slimy, or is it because they've been taught since they were verbal, don't ever touch a mushroom, they're poisonous?
Mm-hmm. To what extent are we really going to get those differences from people? I think that's not.
Yes.
Yeah, but it's a great question to ask, and thank you for that.
Just a quick comment along the same lines. I think it's fear of nature or disconnection with nature.
Yeah.
And it's the nuancing that our culture no longer really holds. And it kind of goes back to Sylvia's poem of us being the mushroom, of us connecting with being part of nature. We are nature. So it's the disconnect. Anyway, just throwing that out there.
Thank you. And so yes, I think mushroom poisoning is a real fear, and also mushrooms are, we know that most plants and things in nature hold a symbolic and metaphorical meaning for people, and mushrooms have held a very powerful symbolic and metaphorical meaning as tenders of death, and I think that that's kind of the meaning that we're trying to interrogate a little bit as well. So let's move on to another role that fungi play.
So we're going to talk about parasitic fungi, which typically come with a pretty heavy negative connotation, and are perhaps the dark side of this queendom. There are two types of parasites. There are necrotrophs, which ultimately kill their hosts and feed on the dead tissue, and biotrophs, which simply feed on their host. In a different connotation, maybe we can see them more as opportunists or vocal parts of their ecosystems. And if we zoom out from our anthropocentric view, how do the roles of pathogens change? If you're a farmer, gardener, general lover of plants, you're probably familiar with some of these fungi already. Downy mildew inevitably take out basil every year. Rust form on the leaves of fruit trees, and sometimes seedlings die from dimming off. As an opportunist, pathogenic fungi often appear in unhealthy or otherwise altered ecosystems. Perhaps they can be an indicator of these environments. Lack of diversity in an ecosystem, absence of mycorrhizal support, depleted or contaminated soils, and introduction of non-native species all can contribute to the optimal conditions for these fungi to thrive. We can think of it like getting a cold. If we're sleep deprived, haven't been eating well, stressed, and then we get on a plane, we're more likely to get a cold. So pathogenic fungi have incredible destructive potential. Our forests here are perhaps forever altered by them. Chestnut blight brought to the US in the early 1900s by infected Japanese trees wiped out an estimated 400 billion trees. The home I lived in Livingston was built with American chestnut, and that's no longer possible. It's interesting that in Europe, chestnut blight has been mitigated by a viral infection of the pathogenic fungi. In the case of Dutch elm disease, beetles acted as vectors, spreading the spores of the fungi into wounds caused by their nibbling. These blights are necrotrophic, as is chaga and Anthus obliquus, the coveted sclerotia of a medicinal fungi, Cordyceps militaris, another medicinal mushroom, which colonizes insect pupae, potentially influencing their behavior, and the honey mushroom group, we see our Armillaria mellia here. The largest living organism on Earth is the honey mushroom, Armillaria australia, covering 2,400 acres in Oregon and potentially up to 9,000 years old. It cuts up nutrient supplies in their host trees with thick black rhizomorphs. Is it possible that Armillaria is accelerating forest succession by culling weak trees or selectively thinning? And what are the impacts of a change in species composition due to pathogenic activity? The loss of living trees in an ecosystem creates snags or hollow logs, which provide valuable habitat for many creatures, so long as they remain in the forest. Not all pathogenic fungi are so devastating. Biotrophs don't need to kill their host to survive, just to glean nutrients from them. Some are even tasty. Corn smut, sometimes called huilacoche, transforms corn kernels into large saber morsels and is often used in Central American food. There's also fungi that parasitize other fungi, like lobster mushrooms or Hypomyces lactiflorum, which parasitizes Russula or Lactaria species, and abortive Entoloma, Entoloma abortivum, which parasitizes honey mushrooms, creating shrimp of the woods. And not all pathogenic fungi are obligate parasites. Some switch between roles depending on their environment or other unknown reasons. Candida albicans, a yeast responsible for thrush and yeast infections, commonly occurs in our mouths and guts, but it can cause problems when it's out of balance.
Just for those not familiar with Hypomyces lactiflorum, those are some delicious lobster mushrooms that I picked near Hawthorne Valley and enjoyed in pasta. So Mary kind of touched on parasites as sort of being, if we look from an ecocentric view instead of an anthropocentric one, like what do these indicators of disturbance or imbalance reveal about ecosystems if we take a larger picture? And I think the question she poses is a really intriguing one of if we were to not look at what the losses are, how might they be seen as guiding succession in a much larger where if they're wiping out things that are not thriving, they are drivers of succession. They might not be driving it in a way that is advantageous to humans. They might not be driving it in a way that is advantageous to chestnut trees, but taking some of the judgment of a parasite off, what can we learn from parasites' role within an ecosystem?
There's another really good Nance Klemm quote about parasites. All right, what are we willing to risk when we don't believe our livelihoods and vitality depend on the relational pathways that connect our neighborhoods, the health of our urban wildlife, the breathability of our air and soil, when we externalize the questions, when we externalize the answers? This gets me thinking, how do parasites view their habitats? Do they, or are they too self-absorbed in their consumptive economies to realize that they are supported by something larger than themselves? Parasite is a word coined by the early 16th century from para, meaning besides, and sitos, for wheat, and came to mean one who eats at the table of another. I think that that's a really interesting way to think of the word parasite, as somebody who eats at the table of another.
And just sort of, parasitism is a natural occurrence. Healthy ecosystems support parasites for the most part. Parasitism is something that exists in many forms, and for the most part, unless, you know, sometimes we see devastating effects, but for the most part, this is something that coexists with other relations within ecosystems. And a question that came up for us as we were talking about this is sort of, how is the word parasite used in our political and social discourse? How does this word get deployed and at whom is it levied? And I think it's really interesting. We are living in a time when a lot of biological metaphors are used for social elements. And I think this idea of sort of needing to produce, of needing to be giving as much to a system as you're receiving from it, is a political fallacy. It's one that I can choose not to buy into. I can choose to believe that in a healthy system, in a healthy political, cultural, social system, someone can eat at my table and it doesn't mean anything's coming out of my plate. And when we're looking at sort of the social lessons and the, even for me sometimes moral lessons of fungi, I'm really trying to be wary of this discourse about parasitism that makes it seem as though somehow some elements of our society are going to take things from us that we will never get back.
I mean, it also brings up to me ideas about like ableism or like ways that folks are otherwise disadvantaged and may not be able to contribute. And
yeah, or that contributions don't always have to look the same. Yeah. Sometimes having someone else at our table is a contribution to us that enriches us. And we perhaps don't know all the ways yet in which parasites do enrich the ecosystems of which they're part.
Yeah, and trying to move away from a culture of scarcity towards a culture of abundance. All right, perhaps my favorite type of fungi are mycorrhizal fungi, which you're also probably familiar with in some capacity. Some of our prized edibles are mycorrhizal fungi, like the kingbolete, chanterelles, matsutake, and morels. Because of their complex relationships, they have evaded cultivation. Many are generalists or cosmopolitan, associating with plants across families and sometimes at the same time, while some are particular to one host at a time and specific families of plants. Up to 95% of all plants associate with a mycorrhizal partner, almost 80% of them with arbuscular mycorrhizae. So there's seven different types of mycorrhizae over there. The mycelial web that weaves underground can extend exponentially further than the plant's roots, allowing the fungi to access hard-to-reach minerals and water. In exchange for water and essential nutrients like carbon, nitrogen, and phosphorus, the plant provides the fungi with sugars. They barter with their abundances. This relationship is especially important in harsh conditions, like nutrient-depleted soils or disturbed environments where a plant would otherwise struggle to survive. When mycorrhizal fungi begin to establish a relationship with its plant partner, there's chemical signaling that happens between the organisms. Essentially, the fungi ask the plant permission to enter into its roots or its cell wall. Maybe this is a form of biological consent. Suzanne Simard's work on mother trees, which initially inspired me to become interested in fungi, she describes the wood wide web of a common mycelial network linking trees in a stand across species, acting as a conduit for nutrients. The network not only transports nutrients, but also serves as a means of communication. When predation or pathogenic activity occurs in a stand, the message may be passed along through the network to warn other individuals so they can boost their defenses. Thus, the mycelial web acts like the internet or a central nervous system to a forest. Recent research by Samard and colleagues on Douglas fir stands stressed by drought and insect foliation has shown that stress signals and photosynthetic carbon is transferred via mycorrhizal networks to young ponderosa pines, perhaps better adapted to their changing environment. This shows promise in the recovery of ecosystems after disturbance. Many mycorrhizal fungi form a sheath over their host plant's roots called a mantle, which protects the plant from other organisms, and sometimes they even produce antibiotics. Mycorrhizal association helps mitigate the effects of soil salinity and toxicity. Some mycorrhizal fungi form hypogeas, or below ground fruit bodies, as opposed to mushrooms. We call them truffles. They have significant ecological impacts in regard to mycophagous relationships, mycophagous meaning mushroom eater. The fungi need creatures to unearth them and disperse their spores, So they developed highly aromatic compounds that are only detectable in spore maturity to attract partners. Some species of small mammals have co-evolved with Hypogea spongi, like bandicoots with their claws and long snouts, or gray squirrels who eat only eat the outer rind of stag truffles, leaving the spongy inner core of spores to waft in the wind. These small mammals have become more significant as we zoom out, considering the hydrophobic quality of eucalypt-dominant forests. The truffle-seeking rodents burrow through the soil, providing access points for water to infiltrate. In eucalypt forests, where burns are common, fire seems to increase truffle production and correspondingly mycophagy by creatures like Tasmanian betongs. The betongs, which are small marsupials, perhaps filling a niche similar to mice or squirrels in our own environments, become a food source for larger animals. By eating the truffles, nutrient stores in the fungal biomass move upward through the food web. So, rapid spore dispersal post-fire and the cascade of relations following may point to Actomycorrhizae as an early successional species after this type of disturbance. Arbuscular mycorrhizae assist in nitrogen fixation in plants, partnering with bacteria to channel nutrients needed for nodulation and fixation. They may also redistribute nitrogen fixed by rhizobia bacteria to non-rhizobia-forming plants within an ecosystem. Additionally, these fungi produce glomalin, a glycoprotein responsible for the tilth of soil, so like the structure of soil. Glomalin is like a glue which stabilizes soil, holding it together while still allowing permeability with air pockets. Ericoid mycorrhizae are specific to the Ericaceae family, living in extreme environments like the tundra or boreal forest. Ectomycorrhizae flex between host specificity and generalism, associating primarily with tree species. These include our truffle bearers and many of our edible mushrooms. Ectendomycorrhizae are significant providers of phosphorus to plants by digesting organic matter or solubilizing rock. And monotropoid mycorrhizae associate with parasitic plants, Monotropa uniflora, our ghost pipe, or beach drops. These plants lack the familiar green pigment of chlorophyll because they do not photosynthesize. The mycorrhizae draw nutrients from a nearby tree to support the growth of the plant.
Well, so, like, unbelievable the way that mycorrhizal relationships provide for the entire forest. And I don't know, read another quote from Robin Malkmer, who sort of, this quote is actually about the plant relationships between the three sisters, but I found it really apt to be apt for mycorrhizal fungi as well. It's tempting to believe that they are deliberate in working together, and perhaps they are, but the beauty of the partnership is how each organism does what it does in order to increase its own growth. But as it happens, when the individuals flourish, so does the whole. And I think one thing that's really interesting for looking at mycorrhizal fungi is sort of the heart of like, well, how do we support or provide for other organisms? We know at this point in sort of where we are with the climate in the world that there's no way moving forward that benefits us that doesn't also benefit other species on this planet. How are we able to tune into the mycorrhizal network? How are we able to build and support other networks that that are mutually beneficial with other beings that inhabit this planet? Some of the things, so something that I was also thinking about as we were talking about this is sort of how unseen and underground the work is that mycorrhizal associations engage in. And I know we talked about this a little bit at the beginning of our talk with the Sylvia Plath poem, and brought up that sort of idea that this sea change is happening below ground, and it's only this sort of moment of fruiting that you're able to see that change, and it seems like it's happening so quickly, but actually that work has been happening underground. And one thing that just really becomes resonant for me in thinking about social movements and how we organize is like who are the unseen and underground workers in those movements? I went recently to see an incredible concert at the Egg in Albany. It's a band called Our Native Daughters, who are an all-black, all-women banjo group. Their stated mission is to reclaim the soul of country music. That's what they're doing. And they got up on the stage, and before they thanked the venue, before they thanked their producers on their album, they thank their nannies. They thank the people who were home doing childcare, taking care of their children. And one thing that's become really resonant for me in looking at this mycelial network is, okay, well, what's allowing movers and shakers to stand up on political stages? Who are the people home with children? Who are the people catering those events? That's the work that I'm interested in seeing. I'm really interested in lifting up that work and naming it as work, naming it as valuable contributions. And that's one of the big lessons that I've been taking from Fungal Networks as well. Elevating work that's not typically always seen as skilled or valuable. As we mentioned in talking about tending to waste or tending to death, those aren't vocations that our culture holds up as aspirational. And yet, where would our culture be without people tending to death and tending to waste? And raising children and cooking food, all the things that are incredibly valuable. So what would it mean to value interdependence over dependence, over rugged individualism, over kind of charisma? What would it mean to have a culture in which intelligence is the extent to which organisms cooperate, not to which organisms compete? And moving to that kind of model, I'm just gonna step to a very quick sidebar because I know we have a room full of interested mushroom people who may have seen the film Fantastic Fungi that came out a couple weeks ago. Has anyone seen it yet? Yeah, I had a lot of problems with that movie. And I'm gonna be really curious to hear reactions from folks who do see it, but I'm not gonna spend a lot of time on it because only a few people have, but a lot of it presented sort of one mycologist's journey as a heroic journey and like lifted up the heroic journey of one person. And to me, that's pretty antithetical to what we're really learning from mushrooms, which is, it's not about lifting up individuals' heroic journeys, it's about seeing the whole picture of cooperation and of interdependence. So I'll be really curious to hear a lot. And it also focused on older white male mycologists and not on the women of color who've made a lot of their discoveries possible. And I'm happy to talk more with folks who are interested too about the particulars of that, because I know we're kind of reaching the end of our time, but this is a theme that keeps coming up, that you're only going to have an impoverished study if you don't have the voices of a lot of people with different knowledge sets at the table. So
there's a place for everyone at the table.
I think we're kind of reaching the end of, and we're not going to be able to do questions. Is there a way for us to kind of quickly?
All right, so we'll talk just pretty briefly about endophytic fungi. So these are almost like microscopic fungi that live in the tissues of every studied plant. They're incredibly ubiquitous, but we know so little about them. They also live in the guts of ruminant animals and potentially in our guts. So they're parts of the mycobiome. And like I said earlier, they typically have a neutral or beneficial relationship with their host plant and sometimes switch when that host plant is encountering stressors or becomes weak, essentially taking them down as a parasite. So generally, endophytes take a supportive role to their host, increasing their overall growth and productivity, like increasing the fruits of the tomato plant. They reduce abiotic stressors like drought and salinity, and they reduce the uptake of toxins by the plant. Plants may pass on endophytes to their offspring through seed tissues, which is a pretty cool thing, and they can prevent parasitic infections in their host plant by occupying the spaces that those organisms would have been part of, and sometimes release like antibiotics to protect their plant. So in the case of fescue grass, which is toxic to ruminant animals, the endophyte is responsible for alkaloids in the grass, and that was a product of coevolution that prevented insect predation on the grass. Maybe we can just wrap this up.
Yeah, so please come talk to us, talk to Barry about endophytes and everything you've been learning about endophytes after this, because it's pretty incredible.
Also, just briefly, so they may be responsible for the medicinal qualities of plants.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
Incredible. I'm going to talk about lichens today, even though they're incredible. I'm just sort of kind of wrapping up what we've been talking about. we both kind of got really swept into into mycology because of this sort of new paradigms it offers, and sort of both learning about, just learning about mushrooms with people who also love them, getting to be outside in the woods with people who also love mushrooms, but also really finding inspiration for new paradigms in so many different levels, political, social, cultural. Ask me later about how I have used mycology to teach sex ed to sixth graders, and how it's been inspired me to sort of be able to look at systems that don't rely on sexual binaries, that really create a full and rich picture of sexuality in the natural world, which is not always something that's offered to us. It's something I would love to talk more about with anyone who's curious. But also just recognizing that the shared love is what brought us here, that it's kind of created the bonds that we've like made in adulthood. These friendships have really actually been fostered by fungi, and it's a pretty special thing. And do you want to end with this quote?
Sure. Yeah, just echoing again that through discovering fungi and learning how to observe it, I have made some of the strongest connections with other people, that fungi, being these community-minded organisms, seem to inspire that everywhere that they pop up. All right, so who does this land, this place, this city, and all its layers, open sky, tree canopy, shrub layer, grasses, forbs, and crops, topsoil, subsoil, and bedrock belong to? Can we get back to this understanding of shared space as increasingly urbanized animals? It's possible. Our decisions can and do affect our land underfoot, and thus food security, habitat, conservation, living economies, community resilience, soil health, clean water, and air.
If you're interested in some of the things that inspired us, we're really happy to share this with anyone.
Yeah.
Enjoy the,
happy
enjoy
to share
the
resources.
Yeah, so here's some of the reading that inspired us in terms of both ecology and social movements. And we'll be really excited to engage in dialogue with anyone we'd like to, but I think we probably don't have time for questions.
Yeah,
okay. Thank you so much.